Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I'm Ted Kluck, joined as always by my good friends and radio colleagues, Ronnie Martin and Barnabas Piper. Gentlemen, it's getting dark and foreboding outside my my office here, and yeah, there's a lot of concern about the weather here in West Tennessee. Big R, what's it like in Ashtown, beautiful Ashtown?
Yeah, man, it is a lot of concerns here. Everybody was really depressed that it didn't snow around Christmas. Mm. And now that we've kind of experienced some snow and some below 20 degree weather, everybody is bemoaning that it's snowing in below 20 degrees. So yeah, that's kind absolutely. Of that is the landscape and the mentality right now.
You know what's funny, RE offices? I realized I was at an academic conference earlier this week, and people in academia use the word office as a verb. As in
like I office there.
Yeah. I office in Jennings Hall. I used to office in the library. Is this a thing that people do in real life, Barnabas?
Well, in the business world, you can turn anything into a verb.
Like you oh, just, interesting. Yeah, give me an example.
Oh, let me see here. Well, I don't know. Like you just, there's things like incentivize, which I'm not even sure is a real word. You know, incentive is a word and incent is a word, but incentivize is not. You just throw a suffix on the end of it. I'm trying to think of some other ones.
I feel like leverage was one of those. I feel like leverage used to be a noun. Now it's a verb. Like we're going to leverage that, or how can we leverage that?
Yeah. You used to gain leverage or have leverage or use leverage. Now you just leverage because we could cut a one syllable word from that sentence.
Dude, exactly. It's so funny.
This is a fascinating start to the program, fellas. Keep going with this.
Good feedback from our host, Ronnie J. Martin. All right, keeping us on track.
Please, I bet pastors do the same thing as much as anybody. Those, you know, they're gonna go missionalize things or something.
Oh, I think you just coined a new phrase, and I think we need to write that book. Missionalize, guys. How do we feel about that?
Dude, missionalize, just a one-word title.
Yep.
Missionalize. I love it.
I'm in. Don't tell, Jeff Anderstelt or Steve Timmis, but we're going to take what they have created and just build on it, you know?
I love it. Well, speaking of books, gentlemen, we got a great listener suggestion for a topic. And the suggestion is this: wondering what books that are out there that haven't been made into movies would make for great movies. So books that would make great movies. Do you guys have thoughts on that?
Man, books that would make great movies. I've been impressed with some of the things they have turned into movies in the last few years. I don't know if the movies have been amazing, but like Ender's Game, for example, was one that was a rather ambitious, ambitious project. But great book that should have made a great movie if it was done.
Yeah, it
well.
Didn't go too well. The movie didn't turn out.
I never
too
saw
well
the movie one. Because that was a, you know, sometimes you read a book and you're like, man, that would be a great movie, but only if it was perfectly done.
I know they kind of. It's like they did not. Yeah, they didn't execute that in the way that, say, something like The Hunger Games was executed, and it was done well with the right stars and, you know, the right screenplay and all of that to go along with it. But, yeah. You know what I really dug is – and this one was in – I read this book. It was an Eric Larson book called The Devil in the White City, and I read this, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. It's one of my favorite books. Mm. And
also came up on our year-end book list episode
It
as
did,
well.
Yes, with many jokes. But it's finally getting made into a movie with Scorsese at the helm and DiCaprio as the lead.
Dude, that's a power combo. Yeah,
that's going to be big.
That DiCaprio as a psychotic killer is a really, or is he the guy trying to catch the psychotic killer?
No, he's the killer for sure.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's a good choice. I'm so glad they didn't pick Johnny Depp for that or something.
Yes, exactly.
Have you guys seen the recent DiCap picture?
The Revenant?
Yeah.
Haven't seen it yet. I've heard good things.
Yeah, I've heard it's amazing. Have you seen it yet, Big T?
I've not seen it yet, man. I heard it's pretty graphic. I heard I heard he like climbs inside the body of a dead horse at some point, and
oh, they just stole that from Star Wars.
I mean, I feel like that's an image that I could live without seeing. You know, I could probably go the rest of my days without seeing a guy like climb inside of a dead horse, but I don't know. I probably need to see it. I'm hearing enough good buzz that.
Yeah, it looks great. He's probably going to win the Academy Award for it too. It's one of those types of end of the year films that
totally,
just explodes.
Totally. Yeah. Which he should. I think he should win one. You know, at some point.
I think he should. Man, he's one of our A-listers. But this is one of the things I wanted to talk about was, you know, kind of on the topic of books that we wish would get made into movies. What about books we wish wouldn't have gotten made into movies? Well, the one I'm thinking of right now is Blue Like Jazz by our boy Donnie Miller. Mm. And Steve Taylor, who, of course, is from, you know, kind of from my scene, from the music industry from years past. And again, he's a couple generations before me.
Who has a pretty legit reputation in that industry, am I right?
He actually did. He'd actually done some really, really legitimately great things. Great right. songwriter and kind of was a you know, kind of had a way of kind of talking about, you know, things in Christendom in a way that was, you know, kind of poked fun at a lot of our traditions and cliches. And he did it in a really great way, but he kind of turned into sort of a filmmaker, and he kind of had a lot of ambition, you know, kind of trying to break into that particular industry. And so I think one of the first things, if not the first thing he did a couple of years ago, and Ted, I think we were in Toledo when it came out, was he made Blue Like Jazz into a movie. Did you guys ever see that?
I didn't.
That's another one that I just sort of looked at and was like, I read that book. And in my wildest imagination, I cannot figure out how it would make a compelling movie.
Well, dude, it was a book without a story. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there was no compelling really narrative to the book. So how would it translate onto the screen?
There also wasn't really like a character. It was sort of meandering reflections. And that's not a shot at the book, because that can work really well if it's written well. But it doesn't work as well on screen, because there needs to be character and or plot, ideally both, and that lacked both.
I agree. And you know, honestly, though, I'll say this about Blue Like Jazz. People who I trust have told me that it's not nearly as sad and crappy as you would expect it to be.
The movie?
The movie, yeah.
I was going to say, the book wasn't sad and crappy, so.
No, right. So, I mean, I think it's not as bad as we would think, but that's still yet not a ringing enough endorsement to make me want to see it. Yeah. Big R, you've not seen the movie?
I've not. I mean, I admittedly saw I think I saw the first 5 or 10 minutes of it.
Okay.
And it
but
just
that might have been a Hallmark movie. It's hard to know.
You know what? It's well,
the Christmas sweater.
Before all the ha-ha with my Christmas fiction fascination comes out. Let me just say this along those lines is that it felt, no pun, okay, it felt very Hallmark movie the way it started.
Okay.
And it was one of those things.
Flesh that out a little bit if you don't mind.
It's probably hard to articulate in the sense that it kind of just started, and it didn't start very compellingly. And the dialogue sounded a little forced. And it was one of those things where I was about 10 minutes in and I just said, you know, I just think there's something better I have to do tonight. And I think I did. I think I did something better that night. So
I feel like Blue Like Jazz, for example, I mean, it just, that one's not even a story. The book isn't even a story. So turning that into a movie is a really odd choice. But I feel like most of the books that I have enjoyed the most wouldn't make great movies, or it'd be really difficult to turn into a movie, because so much happens inside a character's thoughts. Mm. And that doesn't come out on screen very well. So like,
give us an example of that.
Well, so there's a book called The Brothers K, not The Brothers Karamazov, or however you say that one, but The Brothers K, and it's by, I think it's David James Duncan, something like that. Uh-huh. And it's just sort of traces this family story over the course of about 20 years, and, you know, the father was trying to make it as a baseball player, and it's just, it is all family interaction, family relationships, family drama, how the different brothers and siblings kind of fall off in their own different ways. And it's an incredible novel, and it would be it's just way too complex to turn into a movie. I feel like Peace Like a River by Leif Anger is kind of the same way. So much happens in terms of emotions and thoughts, and there's a spiritual aspect to things, and that doesn't play very well on screen either. Usually.
Yeah, I agree. I read Peace Like a River, which was just flabbergastingly great, and there's so much like thinking in the movie in the book that you don't know how that would I mean, you would have to get some really incredible actors. But I feel like if they attempted it, it just wouldn't even resemble the book enough.
Right. Why Christian movies tend to be kind of cheesy, is because they take things that happen internally and try to verbalize them, and it just comes off kind of cheesy or like a cliche or something, instead of there being that sort of deep soul aspect to things. Which is, I mean, it's why guys like John Grisham write really good books to turn into movies, because they're basically writing a movie script.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's just, you know, it's like problem, conflict, bad guy, good guy. You know, it's all sort of formulaic, and it plays so well on screen.
Well, how about let's bring up this point then. Like, what about some of the recent, in the last few years, sort of this new attempt at doing a legitimate take on some of the Bible stories? You know, everything from Russell Crowe in Noah to this new one they got coming out called Risen, which is, you know, the post-resurrection. I mean, it's like those things. I know that the Christian community is thrilled that the production levels are, like, you know, are raising a little.
They legitimized, but at the same time, us. Like,
the stories, I mean, the stories always seem to lack, you know, really, you know, a little truth, number one, and anything of approaching a more compelling kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, the Bible ones, I'm trying to remember. I think the last Bible movie I saw was
The Bible?
No, it was The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, actually. Nice. I haven't seen any that were made since then.
It's a few years old, so if you're in the audience wondering when that came out.
Spoiler alert, Israel escapes. I did see at least one. I saw the Passion of Christ, too, that one.
And okay.
And of all of the biblical movies that I saw, that one was by far the most compelling to me. But a lot of that's because that's one of the stories that the Bible gives the most detail on.
It's true.
So that they didn't have to guess about what happened next and fill in the blanks. Like, I didn't see Noah because I was like, there's like one chapter on what Noah did.
Yeah.
God told him to do something. He built a boat. They floated around with some animals. And then the boat landed. And then he got drunk and committed incest. And like that's all happens in like 40 verses.
You know, I don't agree with that interpretation at the end there, but we can talk about that on another broadcast.
Yeah, I skipped the high point with the rainbow and the covenant and those kinds of things. I'm thinking from a movie maker's perspective, like, what could we put in there that makes this compelling? Rainbows don't grab the attention quite as much as drunkenness and
it's true
cravenness.
You know, another movie, another one that came out that was West actually cravenness. Really, really great and didn't get a lot of hype. Came out about 6 or 7 years ago, is this one called The Nativity Story.
I saw that one. That was surprisingly good.
It was great. I thought it was fantastic because they really, really stuck to the story as well as you can, you know, needing to make some turns and twists for it to be on screen. But I thought it was really emotional and really compelling.
And they were plausible twists.
Absolutely.
See, I would like to see in terms of – when the listener sent in the question, they said what books ought to be made into movies. I'd like to see some more of the nonfiction stuff. You know, various – like war fiction – or I'm sorry, war books almost always make good movies. Like We Were Soldiers Once and Young. Great book. Fantastic movie. Those kind of ones, or what Spielberg and Hanks did with Band of Brothers, or even The Pacific, which wasn't an awesome miniseries, but production quality wise, it was top notch. Some of that stuff, or like Jackie Robinson story, any of that nonfiction stories tend to make really, really good movies because they don't have to try to figure out what makes a good story. Like, the story is there and it's already good.
Yeah,
maybe I'll adapt the naval history book that I'm reading right now.
Yes.
That I'll be blogging about, and yeah. I'll put down the screenplay that I'm working on currently called The Shepherd's Pouch. It's gonna be a Christmas film.
You and Ronnie are collaborating on that behind my back, aren't you?
We are. The Shepherd's Pouch is gonna be bonkers. It's gonna be amazing.
I'm gonna write a tell-all in about 40 years about how I gave you the idea and I didn't get a dime out of it.
It's funny because Lifeway's putting it out, Piper. I thought you would have known that.
They have pushed me out of the loop, I guess.
We can be in litigation for like a decade over the royalties.
That's right. The royalties won't even cover the litigation costs.
Exactly.
No doubt.
Exactly. We'll all go broke litigating it for years. So on that happy note, man, let's move on. Let's move from books that make great movies and move into a little bit of parenting talk, gentlemen. Somebody suggested that we talk about this phenomenon called helicopter parenting. And Barnabas, give us a little definition, man. A few sentences on what that means and what that is.
It is the style of parenting that is ever present and ever cautious in a child's life. So you don't just send your kids off to school; you drop them off, and then you go in and you're the room mom, for example. Mm-hmm. Uh, you you can't just send your kids out to play like we used to as kids, where they're just gone for an afternoon. There's, you know, periodic check-ins. There's, it's just, right. It's the phenomenon of always being in your kid's business about everything. And, but it's like the protective aspect of it. It's not just sort of wanting to lovingly know how they're doing and what's going on, but trying to protect them from everything in the world all the time. And it probably involves about a gallon of Purell a week.
And why the overprotectiveness? Because here's my – okay, so I heard a stat, and I don't know how to substantiate this, but I heard a stat that said, you know, when you look at the things that parents are really, really frightened about, which is like kidnappings and those types of things, I heard a stat that said that like today there's not any more than there were back in our day when our parents let us roam for like 5 days in a row without ever seeing us. It's just that the 24-hour news media coverage we have, it actually heightens those things when they do happen. So it makes it feel like they happen more frequently. But in actuality, like the world, you know, and I'm putting quotes around this, the world is just as safe now as it was like back in 1981 in those types of ways.
You know, and I asked my parents about that because, you know, as a parent myself now, I remember what they used to let me do. They'd basically be like, it's summertime, come home by dinner. And I was right. On my own, you know, and I could come home for lunch if I wanted to. But I mean, I just get on my bike and go ride around and play ball and play with friends and disappear for hours at a time. If my kids did that now, and I don't consider myself a helicopter parent, but if my kids did that now, I would freak out not knowing where they were. And that's, and I don't think I'm alone in that. I don't think most people just let their kids go. And so I asked my dad, I said, what was the difference? You know, do you think there was less of this stuff going on then? And he said, I just don't think we knew much about it. So there was a feeling of safety. But I do think that the feeling of the lack of safety that people feel now is probably as much of an illusion as the feeling of safety was back then.
Guys, sure. What do you think is the end game here in terms of church culture, where it seems like, you know, helicopter parenting is kind of celebrated, I think, in our culture, in the sense that, you know, we have all our own sort of homeschool co-ops now and you know, all of our own Christian sports leagues. And I mean, it seems to me that we might be in danger of raising a generation of people who just have no experience interfacing with the outside world and what's more, no interest in interfacing with the outside world. Am I right on that or off base? Or what are you guys seeing where you are?
I don't think we're any different than the secular world. You know, because so when we lived in suburban Chicago, we lived in this, it was like this idyllic little sort of Pleasantville kind of community. And
dude, which burb, if you don't mind me asking?
It was right on the Glen Ellyn Wheaton border. So I mean, okay. It's Pleasantville to a T.
Dude, it is. It's idyllic, man.
You know, tree-lined streets and whatever. And it's this 80-degree August day, and we're driving on the street, and there's not a kid to be seen. Whereas, like back – and I don't think I'm exaggerating. Every summer day when we were growing up, there was just kids everywhere because sure. Your parents kicked you out of the house and said, stop being annoying and go play somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so I think – it's not just the church who's having this effect, but just parents everywhere, where by isolating our kids, by setting up play dates instead of saying, go make friends, you know, everybody's sort of breaking down in terms of the normal interfacing with the world around them. There's not the same sort of social structure there used to be. I mean, you can even see it when you go to a coffee shop. You know, the idea of a cafe used to be that you'd go in and everybody sort of say hi to the people that they knew.
Sure, sure.
Now you go in there and you don't know the baristas and you don't know the people at the tables, and you sit down with your book or your laptop or your phone and you do your discipleship with the one person you're there to meet and you leave. And so I think it's just sort of it's a strange sort of antisocial culture because everybody's suspicious of everybody. Like parents don't let their kids spend the night at friends' houses anymore for fear of the older brother or the dad or whatever.
Yeah, and yet everybody feels as though they're being social because they're on quote unquote social media all day long. So
and they're all part of the PTA,
right?
Which is
it's crazy, man.
My least favorite organization.
I guess I worry about, you know, the mandate that we have to go and make disciples, given everything that you just said. You know, if we have no experience in slash interest in like going and engaging people, how are we going to do that?
I think. Well, yeah, you're, what you're talking about is you're talking about we want to be we want to remove all risk.
Yes,
and we think by removing all risk in our kids, it's somehow, some way, it's going to prepare them better, not just for life, you know, because they're going to be thrust into the real world doing real jobs, and they'll get acclimated to that. But
not,
I think
not with our help, though.
What's that?
I said not with our help. We're certainly not helping them get ready for that. Like the real world is going to bite a lot of people.
But even we're talking about what Big T just mentioned in terms of like being the church, in terms of like being disciple makers. I think it probably affects that even more adversely and more negatively. You know what I mean? Because that when we talk about the Great Call, I think if we are so afraid to allow our kids to have to engage to a point where they have to face adversity, well, then what kind of adversity are we preventing them from facing in terms of just being disciples? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think the implications of that, I think, are even further reaching than saying, okay, you got to learn how to work with other coworkers, exist like in a college environment. It's like, well, yeah, but you're just hanging. You know, anybody can learn how to hang out in those environments. When we're talking about it going much deeper in terms of our faith and you know, sharing our faith in those types of environments, I mean, we've crippled them, haven't we? I mean, well, it's just –
and I think we've bred deep suspicion into into our kids and into ourselves. It's very, very hard to reach out to a neighbor when you won't let your kids go in their house. You know, you can't go. You can't go in their house. We don't know them. We don't trust them. But we do love them and want them to know Jesus. Wait a minute. How do those two things mesh? You know, that's sort of the like stranger danger does come into conflict with go therefore and make disciples, except of strangers because they're not safe.
Yeah. Like Big T, what do you think about that in terms of like, because you have two boys.
Yeah.
Like how do you feel about that in terms of your neighbors? You're in a new neighborhood now, obviously.
Sure.
Yeah, lay that out.
I get it. I mean, I get the temptation as a parent to be ultra controlling and ultra sort of master mindful of everywhere my kids go and everyone they speak with. But I also, I mean, given everything that we've just said, like I really the older I get, I think the more I appreciate like the experiences that I had as a kid interfacing with other people, because I feel like it prepared me for all the interfacing that I do with people in the world now. So I guess my fear is, you know, both in terms of evangelism, there's that piece, but also in terms of the piece that Barnabas mentioned, which is just flat out survival in the world. You know, are our kids going to be completely shell-shocked when they, you know, live in an apartment complex without us for the first time and have to go into an office and have their first job? And I mean, are they going to have their minds blown by all of it? And, you know, I guess that's the fear that I have with all this micromanaging. And I get the sense that people feel like they can sort of game their own kids' sanctification that way. Like, I mean, Reformed people can talk in, you know, flowing white papery language about how important sanctification is, but we live sometimes as though it's the last thing on earth. You know what I mean? Like if I keep them in bubble wrap their entire lives, they'll never have to be.
Yeah. We're not sanctified. So eager for our kids to become sanctified through some, through challenging circumstances. Yeah.
Right. And I just fear that if we as a generation of 30 something parents are all like kind of hyper bubble wrapping our kids, like what earthly good are they going to be to anyone? And are we so reformed that we're saying, well, you know what, the Holy Spirit is going to save everyone and I don't want my kid to have any sort of tangible role in that, you know, and given that, I'm not trying to be sacrilegious. I mean, I know that, you know, the Spirit is powerful enough to do the saving without me or my kid, but I also think there's validity to the mandate to go out and make disciples. And the fact of the matter is doing that is not always going to feel 100% safe.
Well, and every biblical example you see is the opposite of how we are trying to raise our kids.
Right.
It is pushing out into risky circumstances and unpleasant places and public discourse and like all of these things that, you know, talking to strangers, you know, people in the Bible times, you know, Philip jumped up in a chariot with somebody and rode with him, some stranger, just to tell him the gospel. Like if your son, Ted, jumped in somebody's car and said, well, I just wanted to tell him about Jesus, I doubt you'd feel like that was the Holy Spirit's leading.
Yeah, discipline is coming.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not saying that – I mean, there's obviously a level-headedness to this. But like when I did youth ministry, we had parents who were freak – they would freak out about where we would take their kids on short-term missions trips. And, you know, I mean, and some of these are short-term missions trips like from the suburbs of Chicago into the city of Chicago. Did you talk to homeless people? Yes, that's why we were there. Though, you know – so that's so counter the biblical example that yes, the Holy Spirit can do a lot of things, but there is also a depiction of how God tends to work and how God has called us to be. And then not to mention just this, I think we're socially crippling them in terms of teaching them to be a bunch of sissies. Like take some risks, learn how to fall down and get up and brush your own knees off, you know?
Well, let me ask you guys this, because you guys are dealing with younger kids than me. So do you guys feel some level of pressure though? Because I think part of it is like the to the level that you're going to feel judged by other parents with how much you let your kids out, you know, how much you take your hand of control off of your kids. Like, how would you – like, if your neighbor knew that you just – like, Ted, you have boys. So if your neighbor knew that you just let your boys, like, wander one summer, you know, afternoon from, like, 8 in the morning till 5 at night, I mean, they would be judging you. I mean, how does that affect you?
Dude, they would. And honestly, I think we'd be much less inclined – you know, we're not inclined to do that anyway. I mean, if anything, we're – you know, I'm definitely more controlling than my parents were.
Yeah.
For good or for bad. Yeah, I mean, I think it's not so much pressure, Big R, as it is – or judging. I mean, it's just the prevailing church culture that we're in. You know, everybody homeschools. Everybody, like, does the same co-op. Everybody does the same stuff. They all play in the same, like, Christian basketball league. And it's not so much judgment. I mean, we don't feel judged by any of those people for sending, you know, Tris to public school. It's just, like, if you want to have any sort of a social life in your church, you end up – sort of wanting to do the things that other people are doing, but then you wake up and realize, wow, I haven't talked to one person from outside the, you know, the bubble of, you know, my Christian college or my church in the last 3 months, you know.
Yeah, you're saying like you're still just staying within the parameters that have been set for you by the the church culture that you're already in. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, boys, this has been fascinating. We've got one more kind of culture engaging topic to talk about. And it's a topic of like consumer charities. So the way that companies will attach sort of a charity mission in order to get people with, you know, white guilt or other motivations to buy
their product. Or just deep pockets.
Or just deep pockets, exactly. And it speaks to this whole idea that, you know, people like throwing their money behind a cause. It makes them feel more noble to feel that, you know, some underprivileged person somewhere is going to get something out of my probably extravagant purchase. I don't know. How does this sit with you guys, Barnabas? What's going on here?
Well, I think there's two sides that come to mind, and one is the consumer side, which is if I'm going to go buy a pair of shoes or buy a cup of coffee, I do get sort of a nice little a little boost of self-justification if I know that some small fraction of that purchase is going to meet a need somewhere. Even if I don't know how that's going to happen, that was the advertisement, I'll believe it. So I feel good about my consumption. The other side, though, and this is the side that I'm a little bit more intrigued by, is the starting of these businesses. And, you know, there's a spectrum of motives behind this. There's the entirely pure motive where as much of the proceeds as possible are going to a good cause. But then there's the other side where it's just sort of the cause becomes it's just a marketing tactic. And you see this with businesses like Target. You know, Target has done so much for the community. No, Target is trying to make people feel good about shopping at Target so people will buy more things at Target. I mean, that's
right.
I don't think that Target has a conscience and cares that much about local public schools. And you know how I know this? Because they canceled their 1% donation to local schools this year because they're financially strapped.
Yeah.
A conscience would say we can eat 1%.
Sure.
And so it's that kind of stuff that I look at and go, why do you need to Why do you need to profit off of a cause? Why can't the cause be the cause and the profit be the profit? And you just you market based on the quality of the goods as opposed to the feeling that you're giving somebody for purchasing them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had somebody ask me one time at a, I think it was like a writing conference, and I was selling some books, and it was a younger person, and he asked, like, completely serious, like, are you going to keep the profits to your book? Like, your royalties, are they going to go to charity? And I was just like, A, there's not going to be that many royalties. I mean, given the arc of my career, I'm not expecting, like, it to be raining cash like a 50 cent video. But the other thing I said was, like, yeah, like, this is how I make my living. And I mean, he was almost shocked that, you know, really, like, you're not, you know, you're not giving to charity. I said, like, I'm tithing, you know, I'm doing my own personal giving, but yeah, there's almost, I think, in younger people, the expectation that, you know, your product is going to come with some sort of social justice motif attached.
It's like there's, I think you mentioned this before we got on, just the that idea of there being sort of a capitalism is inherently sinful,
yeah,
mindset. So
yep. Yeah.
we need to do something to put some soul in it or to undermine it or something. And what have you seen from the many college students you have interacted with, just kind of their attitude towards these things?
Yeah. College students love that, man. I mean, they're easy marks. I think for any company that's sort of, you know, marketing anything to that age group, I mean, you attach a little social justice to it, man. And the thing could go bonkers. Tom's obviously was the example from like 5 years ago. Everybody was wearing, you know, really flimsy canvas shoes around for a while because, you know, because of the crack marketing job that company did, and more power to them. I mean, they knew how to sell a product to their audience, and, you know, people felt so good about themselves and so good about like putting the Tom's sticker on their laptop and, you know, wearing the crappy flats around, and but then, as all things do, it jumped the shark and people got tired of it, and now it's something else. But yeah, it is strange. I mean, if anything, it's sad to me just how easily manipulatable we are. You know, how easy it is to throw some junk product at us if we feel like we're, you know, doing good because of it. I don't know, Big R, where do you see this play out, man?
I don't know. You know, I've never been, I'm one of the least hippie people I've ever known in my life. So I've never been a big cause guy. Mm-hmm. I don't feel very easily manipulated by causes. It's just not where my head is wired and where it tends to go. Mm-hmm. But I do like to, you know, you look into something like Tom's, you know, and there was a lot of the marketing went into, you know, it was kind of a, if you sort of watched how they marketed it, number one, they created a product that was really appealing.
Sure.
You know, my kid wore Tom's, she loved Tom's. Mm-hmm. She was taken in at the age that she was at, that she was taken in by Tom's. It had nothing to do with the cause because she mm-hmm. was a little, she was at that age where it was a little pre-cause,
sure.
You know, but I know people that were up and, you know, getting into their late teens or early 20s, it went from just being fascinated with the product to being more about the cause, but then also loving the product. So I think that there's something fascinating when, you know, the guy that really marketed the branding for Tom's, I mean, they spent a lot of time on the cause aspect of it as much as they did with the design aspect of it. So I can actually look at something like that and go, well, look, man, I mean, it was a legitimate product. There was a stylistic intent behind it. As well as, hey, we are trying to help some people here. So I think with that, I think that's an example of to where, for me, it worked on both levels. To where I thought, well, it feels like there's some legitimacy to it because they went so far down the road to market both aspects of it rather than just saying, forget the product, man. All we care about is the cause. Well, it's like, well, you should kind of care about the product too, right? And so I guess with these types of things is I'm just – if I'm noticing at all, I'm just trying to see what it is that they're most concerned with pitching me.
Yeah. Well, I'm on the Tom's website now, man, and they have morphed from just a shoe company into – you can get all kinds of things through Tom's now. Coffee mugs, obviously leather-bound journals. That was a natural.
Yeah, I wonder what their big seller is right now within their product line.
Dude, I don't know, to be honest, man.
I think the shoes are still up there. I mean, just because, look, if 40-something-year-old dudes still wear Vans, there's a there's about a 12-year segment worth of people who still wear Toms.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they've got bags. I mean, you can get your overpriced canvas bag. You can get your...
Is it still all based on the, if I buy this, somebody in need gets one of these? Like, if I buy a coffee mug, does some thirsty college professor get a coffee mug or something?
Dude, no. I mean, hopefully some, like, third world college professor in like a hut somewhere will get a coffee mug.
Because
you know?
That's what they need is a coffee
mug. Dude, these coffee mugs, I kid you not, man. They're $24.
Goodness sakes.
$24.
Was there any, I forget, man, was there any sort of, was there any, there was no religious intent attached to
Toms,
was there?
No, so. Okay. Toms, they had, part of the marketing genius behind Toms was the buy one, give one.
Yeah.
Idea.
Yeah.
So I buy a pair of shoes, and for every pair that is purchased, a person in need gets a pair. And so you feel like you are buying two pairs of shoes, essentially, one for you and one for someone in need. And now a couple years ago, this article came out about how Toms and other companies like them had actually undermined local economies around the world because there's just been like this massive influx of free stuff. So local businesses were just put under because nobody would buy their stuff anymore because they could get it for free.
So interesting.
I mean, and that's true of a lot of charity efforts. I mean, you can go read like Toxic Charity by Bob Lupton and some of these other books that just show how our intent on sort of throwing charity at people often hurts more than it helps. But no, I mean, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this because, yeah, I mean, Toms may have been like Ronnie said, there was a style to it. People really liked them. They liked the way they looked, etc. And they were – the cause wasn't bad. Maybe the execution was. Maybe it wasn't planned very well. But I don't know. It just there's always something that makes me a little bit squeamish when I'm walking into somewhere intending to buy good for purely purely consumptive reasons. So a nice cup of coffee – and I'm now choosing between a nice cup of coffee and a nice cup of coffee that is, you know, locally grown or I'm sorry, locally roasted or free trade. And the original farmer in you know, Guatemala is going to get paid fairly and those kinds of things. And just like I don't even know if those are real claims or if that's just a marketing spin to hook my business.
Dude, I can tell you this, man. The next pair of hipster sunglasses that you purchase, Barnabas, needs to come from Toms because you can get into a model here. I'm just going to read you the name of it. It's called Coffee Grain. Ooh. This is a type of sunglasses. And it's $159, man. So, I mean, definitely don't like accidentally sit on those in your car. Don't leave them at the ballpark.
I felt guilty for spending a third of that on a pair of sunglasses not that long ago, and right. I haven't lost them yet. But so, all right. Well, the next time I buy hipster sunglasses, I'll keep that in mind.
Actually, if you want to go bargain, man, we can get you into this model called Amber Ale for $149.
So they're like craft beer sunglasses.
Sort of like craft beer. Yeah, they're naming the sunglasses.
Their sunglasses are all beverages.
Yeah, exactly. They're all beverages. So maybe when you buy a pair of these sunglasses, a poor person gets a craft beer.
Do they have like a pure cane? They have like a pure cane sugar extract.
Yeah, maybe he gets a mug of craft beer. Let's see what else we've got here. We've got
promoting drunkenness the world over.
When are we going to see a line of Christian craft ales, fellas?
Oh, dude, it's got to happen. In fact,
not happened?
I have read more than one article about like Christians in the brewing space. You know, they work at brew pubs or they are brewers.
That, dude, they're a dime a dozen. It's all about that. But yeah, it's just – but a guy that literally has like a brewing – like a Christian craft like ale company. Like, dude, it's incredible that has not happened.
Guys, let me float a concept by you, okay? Wait for it.
Throw it.
Happy Rant Brew Pub.
Oh.
Huh?
Happy Rant like Ale.
We could call it the Hoppy Rant Pubcast? Brew Pub.
Oh, pipe. That's why you work in marketing and that's we right. don't.
Wow.
That's brilliant.
Yep.
I guess our friends at CalvinistSwag.com need to start designing a new
pint
sweatshirt
glass.
For us.
Yeah, absolutely. Hoppy Rant.
But just remember, I'm still Baptist, so I'm not allowed to officially participate in any of this.
That's so funny you say that, Pipe, because all of my SBC friends are like the,
you know, they can't stop guzzling all the hops.
Yeah, which is why the Missouri Baptist Convention wants to kick them all out, for example.
Oh, okay. It means I'm going to get kicked out right now because I just, like, you know,
there is a rift in this world that we have to tap dance around.
Well, you know what? And let me add my caveat too. I want nothing to do with the Hoppy Rant Ale. So we'll just sell that concept.
That's right.
It's great to not be a Baptist, isn't it?
Baby, I'm working for a Baptist school now.
Yes,
so
you are.
My life is different.
Oh, my gosh.
My life is
different.
That's
rough.
But it's good, man, and I love my gig. And, guys, we've wandered to and fro on this program, haven't we?
That we have.
And are we not piloting a new sign-off today?
That's up to you, my friend.
Give me a name. I need... We're doing just random sort of Christian authors, aren't we?
I mean, I think something should be able to dawn on you in the next like 21 seconds for sure. Mm.
All right. We can let that play. And in the meantime, while I'm thinking during those 21 seconds, I want to use the 21 seconds to give some love to our boys at Resonate Recordings.
Yes.
They make our voices sound lush and appealing, and they will do the same for you. So check out Resonate Recordings for all your podcast and music recording needs. With that, guys, I've already mentioned how to and fro we've wandered. So until next time, Donnie Miller.
In a recent survey, parents reported that 52% of homeschooled children need learning accommodations. These parents need practical advice, encouragement, and hope to fuel their homeschooling efforts. The Empowering Homeschool Conversations podcast is where parents gain wisdom on how to teach unique learners successfully at home, like Laura, who recently told us, "I needed this episode. I don't need a fancy curriculum or need to be a special ed teacher to teach my son. You have given me hope." To listen now, go to Life Audio or search Empowering Homeschool Conversations on your favorite podcast app.